This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, a good Sunday morning to you.
Good Sunday morning to you, Scott. You know, today we have a very interesting guest. And Dr. John, as I'm going to call him, who is the new head for the Institute for Positive Education, is going to be talking to us about this really interesting new grant-funded initiative at the university, $9.4 million from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation. And so we're going to learn everything about that. But I just want to give kudos to Dennis and Phyllis Washington. For 40 years, they've made a commitment to philanthropy and to the University of Montana. We have a stadium. We have a school of education. We have this program. We have the Championship Center. They have really committed, and Dennis was not a college student. Phyllis graduated from the university, and the two, and Kyle and Kevin, attended and graduated from the University of Montana, but the man with the checkbook didn't. But he has made a lifetime 40-year commitment to funding. And this is just the latest of, a long series of gifts to the University of Montana. And so I wanted to give them a pat on the back for that commitment to the university. And I'm anxious to hear about how this $9.4 million is going to be spent in the educational arena.
Indeed, indeed. Our guest is Dr. John Summers Flanagan, professor at the University of Montana Department of Counseling. Back after these words. Arnie Sherman, we are back with our guest, John Summers Flanagan, professor of UM's Department of Counseling and the director of the Institute of Positive Education.
So can I call you Dr. John? I always wanted to call one of our guests Dr. John, and is that okay?
That would be perfect, Dr. John. In fact, when I was working, I used to work at a Job Corps, and all of the students would call me Dr. John, so feels pretty comfortable.
Yeah. So you worked out at Trapper Creek, right down in Darby area?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I was a mental health consultant there.
Yeah. So before we talk about this fantastic gift from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation to the School of Education, $9.4 million to create an Institute for Positive Education, I want to talk a little bit about Dr. John and your background. So tell us a little bit about how you've meandered into, being where we are today.
Yeah, maybe the thing I like to say first is that I taught my very first course at the University of Montana in 1982. Wow. I was a doctoral student in clinical psychology, and as part of my internship or my assistantship, I got to teach introductory psychology, and I just fell in love with teaching and loved teaching after that, and my life has kind of meandered a bit since then, but mostly I have been, since 2003, I've been a professor of counseling in the Department of Counseling at the University of Montana. I've also taught some courses off and on in the psych department, and for a couple of years I was an assistant professor at the University of Portland. In between all that, I've done a fair amount of clinical work. I was the executive director of Families First, a parenting education organization in Missoula. Right. And then I was also a mental health consultant for Trapper Creek Job Corps. All of those experiences, and I was in full-time private practice for a little while. So all those experiences sort of have come together for me over the last 40 years. In that I've started thinking, we maybe are focusing way too much on what's wrong with people instead of what's right with people.
Well, that's an interesting approach. And as you know, from your experience, I was a psychology undergraduate major and studied criminology in graduate school, and actually was accepted, but didn't do it into a PhD, a clinical psychology program at NYU in New York.
Wow.
So I've dabbled enough to be dangerous, but you're right. There's so many different ways to approach things. And often it's looking at the disease rather than, the positive side of things. But I do want to ask you, it seems like a lot of your career has been focused on children and youth and the families around them.
Yes.
So what has changed when a client comes in to see you, whether it's on the university campus or it's in a Family First program, or you're talking with students or young people at the Job Corps site or in your private practice? What things have changed over these past 20 to 40 years?
Wow, that is a huge question, and I think a great question. But the first thing, of course, that comes to mind is the social media phenomenon, which I think complicates so much. It complicates parenting. Obviously, kids can have access to material and screens, and you have a couple of things going on at the same time. One is that you don't have much control over the content that your kids are experiencing, right? And learning from, maybe instead of you, instead of the neighbors, or instead of other people, they're learning from some online resources. The other thing is that we know screens are a little addictive, and they really are not good for building the ability to focus and to be able to focus in on what's happening in life. And so we see a lot more kids with attentional difficulties and a lot more kids who are learning a huge amount of content from the internet instead of from families, schools, neighborhoods, things like that. So I think those are a couple of things that come to mind right away.
Well, as you point out, in a couple of generations, we've gone from maybe two or three TV channels and a few radio stations, right? And a few hours a day doing that to it's 24/7 all the time, everything bombarded. You can't even make a decision on what to choose. Scott and I are often approached, we have people say, "Have you watched this series? Have you watched this series? You should be watching this," from friends or whatever. And it's overwhelming. Most of the stuff that they've been into, I've never heard of. And that would not be the case 25 years ago. Everybody would have watched MASH on TV, or even 15 years, everybody was watching Sopranos if they had if they were access to that kind of media. Now there's just so much content out there. How do families strive to get their kids to focus on the world around them?
Yeah, I think that's a huge challenge for parents. And I think when one thing that's similar now as it was 40 years ago is that parents tend to lean one direction or the other. They either become very authoritarian, it's like my way or the highway, and they maybe become excessively focused on discipline and behavior and not very focused on compassion and empathy and democratic decision making. Or they shift the other way and they become extremely permissive and they kind of let the kids drive what's happening in the family. And we know from quite a lot of research that the best kind of parenting is somewhere in the middle, where the parent is still an authority figure, but maybe not a dictator, where the parent has compassion and empathy for the child, but doesn't let the child choose what we're having for dinner, because that's going to be ice cream, or it's not probably going to be the best decisions. And so I think parents still have the same trouble staying in the middle. And so what happens is then they kind of abdicate some of their parenting to the internet or all the things that are out there, or else they're highly restrictive and maybe too punitive and they don't have a good relationship with their kids.
Why do you think that is, Professor? Do you think that parents are just playing forward how they were raised and the same type of behaviors?
I think both, and it's like some parents are playing forward the way they were raised, and some parents are trying not to raise their kids the way they were raised. We oftentimes react and by trying to be different than the way our parents treated us.
Well, plus
I think.
you forget the fact that they're exposed to the same, they're inundated by the same media that their kids are inundated. And you can Google anything, right? How to raise my kids? What should I let them, choose dinner or not? And you get 40 different opinions about everything.
Well, and and parents, I see a lot of parents, on their phones, right? And that they're focused maybe a little more on their phones than they are on their kids. And that's in some ways another sort of a distraction or addiction that takes away from parenting.
I was at a restaurant the other day, and there was it looked to be, I didn't know them, there was a mother and father and three kids, probably from 9 to 14. All five of them were on the phones over dinner. They weren't even talking to each other. They were all into whatever they were into and sitting around the
You see
table
that a
with
lot.
no
You see that a
interaction.
lot.
Yes.
No interaction at all.
Yeah,
So
I do think
let me
it's
ask you how
hard.
count. Let me ask you the flip side of
Yes,
this.
yes.
So you have your clients and the organizations that you're working with grappling with AI and chat GPT and social media and then school shootings and these other things going on. What about the approach a professional like yourself has? How has that changed? I mean, it used to be there would be cognitive, behavioral stuff, or you would be if you were advanced, you'd be an Adlerian guy or a Freudian approach to how you would deal with, your patients. How has that changed over the past few decades?
Oh, wow, so much there. So one thing that's different right from the very beginning, if you're doing counseling with young people, but also with older people, is that they often come in with a very clear belief about what's wrong with them. Maybe they've seen it on TikTok. We see that a lot with kids. They're watching TikTok. They've watched about ADHD. They've watched about trauma. They've learned about bipolar. And a surprising number really will come in thinking that they have Asperger's syndrome, which is really pretty unlikely. But they
Right.
identify with a diagnosis, with a label early on. They come in. And so, in some ways, our first contact with kids is a lot different than it used to be, no matter which theoretical approach or that we're going to use. But we have to try to help. And if you tell the young people, no, you don't have ADHD, it's unlikely that you have Asperger's syndrome, they often, they don't believe you. They believe their own lived experience because they think they've discovered this thing about themselves, a very common thing. And back in the day, they referred to that as medical student's disease because whenever you read about a disorder, you think you got it.
Right,
This
right.
is super powerful for kids and the way that they identify themselves as young people, but also going forward. I'm ADHD. I can't possibly focus and pay attention, and so they kind of construct this reality and they make their symptoms more extreme by believing too much in the label. So I think we have to address that. But another interesting thing that has come around, since 40 years ago when you and I were studying psychology. Is that instead of more theoretically based approaches, we have shifted a little bit to procedures. And for better or worse, procedure like EMDR, eye movement desensitization reprocessing, and that might involve different kinds of bilateral stimulation and tapping and things like that. So there's a little more emphasis on therapists wanting to learn these procedures. One of the things that we try to emphasize in our program at the University of Montana is how important the relationship is, and to make it really good, have a good therapeutic relationship and a connection, so that we then have a little bit of leverage that we can use to help young people maybe deconstruct their beliefs about what's wrong with them. And be able to focus a little bit more on
So
their strengths.
break it down and build it, build the information up. But how, tell us, how does pharmacological, aspects of treating illness impact the work that you do? Because I see that as an incredible incentive for someone to self-diagnose, is they could get this magic pill or that magic pill.
Right.
Yeah. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I teach in a counseling department. And so what I'm going to say next will reflect my bias, right? I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a physician. But one of the things we often say is a pill is not a skill. Now, although a pill might help you with some symptoms, might reduce some symptoms, it's not the same thing as learning some skills for dealing with your family, for learning some skills for dealing with bullies, for learning some skills for focusing on your strengths during those times when you feel like you're going to flunk a test, right? And so we really like to emphasize skill building as something that then the young people can use to address their symptoms. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't think medications can't, we think that can be helpful sometimes, but our bias is toward the psychosocial or the psychological interventions. And oftentimes it's both and, right? And but you're
Right.
right. There's some kids who are thinking, well, maybe if I just get a little bit of Ritalin, or if I get
Adderall.
the Adderall, if I can get that, maybe that's going to help me to function better on tests or in other areas in my life.
You make a really important point about that. Plus the fact that social media not only impacts them in all sorts of tangential ways, but the self-diagnosis thing, just have so many more avenues to check out what I think is wrong with me, and I go online and
Right,
give up,
like
and you just give it.
WebMD. Yes.
Well, mutated to the max, right? There's all kinds of vehicles to look at, and then you just get lost in it if they spend hours doing it.
Yeah.
You're teaching educators who want to, further their educational careers and their professional careers in counseling. Are you seeing a different student now than you saw 20 years ago?
Yes. Several things that are different. In some ways, they're much more worldly and sophisticated. And often they're much more passionate. They kind of know what they want and they know what they believe. Now that can be both a strength and a weakness,
Right.
right? People who believe something. I remember, trying to teach a class one time on intimate relationships, and I was trying to. And one of the research-based findings is that, as it turns out, males are capable of as much empathy as females. And as I was teaching about that, I took a little survey before and afterwards, and I had several of the students say, "No, I didn't believe it because I know what I believe." And I'm like, "Well, as it turns out, males, I mean, it is true based on the research, and maybe didn't fit that student's experience, but then they sort of rule things out based on their own lived experiences." And I try to emphasize with them, and because lived experience is great, and they talk about it a lot and how important it is. But if we just base our knowledge and our strategies in working with people on our own lived experience, what happens is it's so narrow, right? I mean, my experience is so narrow. I need to really be super interested. If I'm working with Scott in counseling, I need to be really interested in Scott and Scott's lived experience. And I need
You
to
need to
sort
do more of counseling with Scott, actually. You might be able to sign him up after this. One of the things that you point out is your experience is limited. So now you have Montana kids coming in who generally, I taught for 17 years at the university. They're generally limited in their worldliness. Then you have
Yes.
students coming in from other areas who are much more worldly. Then you have international students with a totally
Yes.
different cultural background. What are the differences that you see among the, that population base?
There's always the risk of overgeneralizing,
Right.
and I want to say that I love the University of Montana students, all of them, right?
Right.
And yet I do see maybe a little more fragility among the students especially who are kind of from the dominant culture, right? They're not the international students. For the
Right.
international students, the international students are often like, I mean, they just want to do anything they can to be successful at the university, and they really work hard. They have other challenges because of often language issues, but they are kind of all in.
Right.
Whereas with the American students, if I were to overgeneralize, and this is not
Right.
always true, they don't read as much as they used to. And I
Right.
think that's just a pretty common
Mean,
thing
a
that we
book?
experience.
What's a book, right?
Right. I've got some textbooks in counseling and psychology, and I'd love it if they'd read them, but.
Yeah. I even remember the books I read when I was in college as a psych major, and
Yeah.
it was one about psychology and society by a guy named Tomatsu Shibutani, a Japanese professor. It was my first exposure to an international writer about psychology, and his
Wow.
approach at that time was much different. Plus, you got ethnic differences. You don't see that much in Montana, but I'm always reminded when I think about this, and I do every once in a while, about how Tony Soprano was with Dr. Malfi on The Sopranos, and having somebody like that as a patient, or as, would be completely different than some student from Havre, Montana, who came walking in, that had a problem. Not just because of what he had done in his life, which was bad, but just from his cultural and ethnic background and experience.
Absolutely. There's so many different ethnicities and values and perspectives out there. And we haven't even touched on the whole issue of gender and sexuality, which is another one of those diverse identity issues that strongly affects how people how open they are, and there's a lot of judgment that goes back and forth, again, amongst all different perspectives. And that's one of the things I think that's a little bit, it's a little dangerous now. Maybe there's just more, I think this is a social media phenomenon, just more quick to judge, just really quick to judge instantly. Somebody says, they're pro this or pro that, boom, they're in a category. And people assume they know everything else or the rest of the story. I like to always try to tell our students, there's so much more to everybody than what we see and that what we hear. All kinds of depths and chapters and things about them that we don't know. And it's important to try to learn about that and have empathy for their experiences.
Quick ID. Our guest is Dr. John Summers Flanagan, professor at the University Department of Counseling and the director of the new Institute of Positive Education. Arnie.
So, tell me about the genesis of the Institute. I'm getting an idea of how it, what the backstory is on it, but why don't you give us the full story of how, from an I guess an idea or a desire for the counseling program to, become more encompassing, it led to almost a $10 million grant from Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation.
Right. And of course, this is more than counseling. This is all teacher education, right? It's the whole college of education, including educational
Right,
leaders.
because ev teachers are dealing with all, I mean, they're dealing with school shootings, they're dealing with kids in their class. I mean, they're dealing with the same problems we've just been talking about, and they have no training for dealing with that whatsoever.
So true. Yeah. So really, and I may not have the complete story perfectly, but here's what my understanding is that Phyllis Washington, and I want to say how grateful I am to her and to the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, but that she wanted to do something about children's emotional and behavioral health. We often hear the word mental health and how mental health is going downhill. And we see more symptoms, more despair, more suicide, more depression, more anxiety. She wanted to do something about that. And I think that there were a lot of efforts to try to figure out, well, how can we best honor that desire with something that we can do that maybe we can do better than anyone in the United States, right? That we can do something that's worth that honors her investment in us. And so basically Dan Lee and I were in lots of conversations with each other and with other faculty in the College of Education. And we decided that, there are a couple of basic rules about positive psychology and about psychology. And you may remember these from, but one thing is that what you pay attention to grows, right? And the more you pay attention to it, the more it grows. Another one is that we naturally focus on negative things. Like when we lie down to go to sleep, most of us do not go through a highlight reel from that day, right? Most of us naturally begin to think, I might, and I'll probably have these thoughts tonight, and it's the fault of the two of you, but I'll be thinking, oh, I should have been more articulate. Oh, I can't believe I said that one thing that I said. So
I
there's that.
usually say I shouldn't have eaten that pizza right before I went to bed.
Right.
And by the way, Dan Lee, who you referred to as the dean of the School of Biz of Education.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for that.
No problem.
So we believe that it's so easy to focus on the negative, right? In ourselves and in others. And the more we pay attention to that, the more it grows. There was an old study published in about 2000 where they looked at all of the research in psychology, and they identified how much of it focused on what's wrong with people and how much of it focused on joy and happiness. The ratio was 21 to 1. We
Wow.
were way better at studying depression and trauma and everything going wrong than we were at studying joy and happiness. So we realized that, partly related to what we've already talked about with kids kind of taking on these negative labels, having them become part of their identity, that if we could shift the mentality of the entire educational system, teacher by teacher, administrator by administrator, counselor by counselor, if we could shift it so that there's a little more focus on how do we grow their skills and strengths, how do we grow their virtues, how do we grow their positive emotions as opposed to their negative emotions. And so that's really where it grew from. And then I got a kind of a modest, wonderful grant from the Arthur M. Blank Family Foundation. And it was all to offer a course to teachers in Montana on evidence-based happiness for teachers. Okay. So at this point, right now, we've had 177 teachers finish the class. It's all asynchronous. I do an opening live lecture, I do a closing pub quiz. At the beginning of class, on average, the teachers score 33% of them are clinically in the clinical depression range. That's
Wow.
not good.
No.
At the end of class, about 12% are scoring in the clinically depressed range. The other things that are amazing about this particular little finding that we have is we give them a bunch of different questionnaires. They're also functioning better physically. Their physical health is better. Fewer headaches, better sleep. I mean, we just have all these great findings. So
So what are you telling them that's making them make this transformation? What's the
well,
secret sauce in this?
I think that one of the things we do, we call it evidence-based happiness. And so we're teaching them these particular practices that have research foundations. So, one might be acts of kindness, and that we know the research is that people who engage in regular acts of kindness feel better. Another one is gratitude, another very simple one. People who have a gratitude practice feel better. We use mindfulness meditation as another technique. We have a thing that's called some people call it joy spotting, but we also call it witness something inspiring. And what that means is, so I might say, Arnie, so for today, I want you just to look for the things that are happening, little things that might inspire you a little bit, just give you a little positive feeling, just to watch for that. Partly because it's so natural for most of us to watch for that which annoys us, right? I'm super, super good at that, So it takes a real mental shift and a practice attitude. So we offer these ideas to teachers. We give them, they have to do these assignments and these reflections, but we also give them a lot of choices. And I feel like that's one of the most important things is we tell them it's okay for you to hate mindfulness meditation. That's fine. Hate it. You don't have to do that. We've got a menu of 14 different things that you can try and experiment with. Pick the ones that work for you.
That's very interesting. And I think, it points out that if you do focus that way, or if you're in an environment that singles those things out or looks at those things more than the negative, you start feeling a little bit better. I'm spending a little time this winter in Las Vegas. And one of the surprising things about living in this area is that all the service industry people are really friendly. More
Yeah,
friendly
right.
than I mean, it's not the normal thing that you would point out, but people have asked me, so what are the things you like about being there, and what are the things you don't like about being? I'm saying everybody's friendly. It makes you feel friendlier when you have those people around you saying, have a great day, and seem to mean it. They're not just saying it as an afterthought. And are you enjoying yourself? Was that good? I mean, it does stimulate a more positive perspective on things, and I think that ties in, to what you're saying. If you focus on every day something that inspires you or is more positive than negative, you're not just watching, the doom and gloom news shows or whatever that monopolize a lot of people's time. They're addicted to that stuff. They have to watch it, and it just makes them, negative all the time. It's really a problem with the
Arnie,
media.
it doesn't hurt that you're getting a ton of vitamin D.
Well, it hasn't rained here in 2 months, and every day
Right.
is sunny. But hey, it's okay. I miss Montana. I miss the good things about Montana.
So three things, quick,
Yeah.
really quick, three things came to mind as you were talking. One is that even though we want people to focus on the positive, we don't want to do this thing called toxic positivity. There's no way. We're never going to say to anybody, cheer up. You should cheer up or look at the bright side. Those are just messages that almost always just makes people annoyed and angry. So you're not going to do that, right? But the research on what you're talking about and what I'm talking about is called the research on positive affect. And that is the more little bursts of positive affect. It doesn't have to be big joy. It doesn't be like, oh, wow, this has been the greatest moment of my life. As it turns out, just little experiences throughout the day is what tends to combat depression better than anything. It's like feeling a little bit better here, a little bit better there.
So now you get 9.4 million bucks.
Yeah.
So how are you going to use it to enlarge what you're finding, which is very encouraging. You got 177 educators that are 25% more positive about themselves than from one course. What are you going to
Yeah.
do with almost 10 million bucks to build on that?
Oh boy. So part of the money, about half of the money, is designated for Washington scholars. And we're going to have a tuition reimbursement program so that when school counselors and teachers stay in Montana for 1 year, they get a third of their loans repaid. Second year, they get another third. Third year, they get
So we
another.
got a lot leaving, right? There's a bunch leaving when they graduate.
Yes, exactly. Right. I think we only retain I think maybe between 40 and 50% of Montana educators, who graduate here stay in the state because they can make so much more in
More
Las
other places,
Vegas.
yeah. Right,
Then
exactly. And then they gamble it away, and then they need your counseling help.
they need
The full circle.
it's
What
a
was the
circle.
third thing, though, John, that you were going to mention? You had one other point.
Well, the one thing that Arnie had said was that how it feels good to be down there and the people in the service industry are interacting with him in ways that are nice and affirming, right? Well, there's an old big famous positive psychologist named Christopher Peterson, and he used to say, I can give you my whole hour-long lecture in 5 seconds and tell you everything you need to know about positive psychology. And people would say, okay, yeah. And he'd say, other people matter. Period. End of lecture. And then he added to this, other people matter, and we are all other people to everyone else. So one of the other things we want to do in terms of the application of positive psychology to education is we're looking at how do we build more positive communities and classrooms, like you're experiencing in Las Vegas, Arnie. We want people to treat one another in ways that facilitate more positive affect and more healthy, constructive, reciprocal, positive relationships.
Is there a greater propensity for your students to be female versus male? Like, what's the gender breakdown?
In counseling, it is often 70 or 80% female in counseling. In the teacher ed, I'm less clear. I just can't. I would have to guess that it's probably 60 or 70% female. I would guess that.
Got it.
In terms of educational leadership and school administrators, again, heavily male. One thing that's interesting is that the University of Montana Educational Leadership Department is starting a brand new women's administrator track within that. Their graduate programs. It's really cool. They immediately got 26 women to sign up to be in this women's educational leadership track. So we hope that maybe we can get a little more balance there.
So the other half of the money will be used for.
The Institute for Positive Education. Now, we will be hiring. We're going to hire a director, a permanent person. It probably won't be me because I taught my first course at the University of Montana in 1982, and we might need somebody who's a little younger. And then we're going to have a couple of clinical faculty positions. We'll have a person who is a community liaison. We'll have a kind of coordinator who's a mastermind making sure everything works. So we have some hiring to do. We have some position descriptions to create. But really what our overall fundamental goal is to improve the emotional and the behavioral health of students in Montana, teachers in Montana, counselors in Montana, administrators in Montana. If we think if everybody's doing better, then we're going to have better outcomes. So how we're going to do that is we will be infiltrating the curricula of the school counselors and of the teacher educators and of the administrators, and have modules in positive psychology and positive education so that everyone who graduates from the University of Montana in education will be oriented and at least knowledgeable about this. And hopefully, they will be experts at applying these principles in the classroom and in the school. So that's really what we're doing is we're going to be building educational curricula. We will be teaching specific contents and strategies, and we will also be we'll have a couple of different we have two different plans for annual events. One of them we're tentatively calling, and this is sort of a joke, but it's the Montana Ed Talks, not TED Talks. Get it, Ed for education. Yeah, and I know that's corny, but what we want is we want to inspire teachers to do some high level teaching speeches on the application of positive psychology in education. And then we'll have a maybe a little competition where they send in some videos, and then we have a day where we get a lot of people. It's a conference, and they come, and we watch and listen to these different Montana educators doing their best presentations on this content that we think is so important. And then we give them some stipends, some awards for
Is
doing
there
it. We record it, we put it online.
is there a model for this, John, in other at other universities or in other communities?
You know, there are some within a college of education. I really don't think so. I've seen some in Australia. I think that there is some positive education programming that's a little bit more robust coming out of Australia. In the United States, University of Pennsylvania has a master's program in positive psychology, but it's not positive education. Berkeley has a big program on positive psychology, but again, it's not housed in a college of education. So that's a little bit, I think it's pretty new. I think we are on the cutting edge here.
Dr. John, let me take a little bit of a tangent on this. And I may not be up to date. I always like to say that I'm so old that when I went to school, they didn't teach history. But
You lived it.
I've lived some of it. Lots of teachers come out with a lack of understanding of resources and other systems that are surrounding them that their students may get involved in. I think best examples is when I graduated, my first job after school, before I went to graduate school, was working in the juvenile justice system. I worked in a halfway house. I knew zero, with a degree in psychology, zero about how that whole thing worked and operated. And lots of kids were having contact with it, whether they were, having, criminal problems, runaways, people that are having, family disputes end up having interactions with these other systems. And you would think educators need to know about some of these resources that are out there. Is that part of this, tangential to this, something that's already being, taught? How does that all fit in?
I'm not a faculty in the Department of Teaching and Learning, which is where the teachers are taught. I am involved in the school counseling curricula, and I know one of the things that we have courses for school counselors that focus on resources, community resources. We also have really extensive internship requirements. Where they have to be in the field for 600 hours their second year, and it's in a school, and they are getting supervised by a school counselor. And so they're out there in the world for a bunch of hours, 300 hours each semester. So that's one of the ways we address it in school counseling. My guess is that it's probably best addressed in teacher education through student teaching, right? So, and I think that probably what students get will depend a lot on their teacher mentor, and how much the teacher mentor knows and is oriented toward community resources.
So the approach that the positive education approach is relatively new. It is, you know, it doesn't have such a robust history. As you look for people to teach this and to, you know, and to, you know, write about it and all that, is there enough background information? Is there enough, you know, literature out there that's going to help inform how this is going to develop, or is it going to be so cutting edge that you're going to be developing it as you go?
Yes and yes. I think there's some pretty good, yeah, I think there's some pretty good foundational content out there that we'll be able to use to incorporate into the existing curricula that that we're working with now. I think we have people already in the Department of Teaching and Learning and School Counseling and Ed Leadership who are interested in contributing in positive ways. We wrote in some incentive money so that we can give existing professors a little bit of incentive money for them to develop their curriculum to include positive psychology. And we want really to nurture their interests so that they can grow it. We want to support them if, for example, they're interested in writing research grants in positive psychology and education. I really envision us as an institution as, I mean, and I think we're further along than almost any place, certainly any place in the Rocky Mountain West. But we're already publishing some papers, and I've got a little research group. We're publishing our study on 177 teachers. Well, we're actually submitting it for publications. I just had a publication come out last week in a nice professional journal that sort of was evidence of the effectiveness of the class with college students. And so we're beginning to, I think, I hope, I believe that we will be on the cutting edge, and I think a lot of other states will be wanting to come the direction that we are going.
Where are you? By the way, John, we should have asked this at the outset. What, give us a little bit of your background. Where are you from originally? What brought you here?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Vancouver, Washington. I went to a community college after high school, and the only reason I went to college, I'm first generation college student. The only reason I went to college was to play sports, right? That was it. It's all. And then I went to Oregon State after that. My dad was a big Oregon State fan, right? My dad, so I went there. I played a little bit of football at Oregon State, and then suddenly I suddenly got interested in academics, and it was almost like I got hit in the head too hard, and I realized, oh no, I'm not going to continue playing football for the rest of my life. And I ended up really loving psychology. I didn't declare it as a major till I was a junior, which is a little late. And then I went on to I worked at a psychiatric hospital for about a year and a half. I applied to various schools. Got into a bunch of them, but my first pick was the University of Montana, where I had a they gave me a full research assistantship and helped pay for my school, and so then I got my PhD from the University of Montana in clinical psychology. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm from. And one of the things that I mean, I got some kind of academic award probably 5 years ago, and I had to give a speech. And it was very emotional. It was like all of a sudden I'm doing this speech and I realize how incredibly transformative it has been. I had no idea there were even such a thing as college professors. And suddenly I am one.
You are one.
I, you know, and And so for me, college was very transformative, and that's one of the reasons I love it so much.
What an inspiring, inspiring journey. Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Dr. John Summers Flanagan, professor in the UM's Department of Counseling. Back after these words. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Professor John Summers Flanagan.
Dr. John, so this is all exciting. It's all with right now encapsulized at the University of Montana. How do we take this into the community so they're aware of it and know about it and, can revel in it as well?
Yeah, we don't want to hog all this information and these ideas ourselves. So we actually will have someone who's hired as a community liaison, and that person is going to be working closely with schools, closely with community organizations. We already have a very strong relationship with the Nate Shute Foundation up in the Kalispell area, suicide prevention. We have a strong relationship with Families First in Missoula. And we've been working really closely with Missoula County Public Schools. But what we really want to do is we're going to be putting interns out there. We're going to be doing presentations throughout the community, not just Missoula, but all through Montana. We want to try to reach everyone. And
How do
so,
we reach you?
oh, well,
If we want people want to, our listeners want to find out more about the program, where can they go to learn?
Probably right now we're in such early stages. We don't have a website right now devoted at the University of Montana. I do have one that's montanahappinessproject.com. That's my small organization. They could certainly learn more about evidence-based happiness there. In addition, you can find me, I am at the University of Montana and I'm listed in the Department of Counseling. And I really encourage people to reach out and to gather more information because we want everyone in Montana communities to be to get to benefit from these ideas. We a couple of years ago we had a thing that we offered online, a social media challenge. It was, we had 20 weeks of happiness challenges that we did, and I think we will probably bring that back through the university so that we have a bigger reach. One of our big goals, I was talking with my wife, she's also a clinical psychologist, and she said, "Well, what if you what's your big goal?" And I said, "Reach. Reach. We want to reach people. We think these are good ideas. We want to have this subversive idea that kindness and healthy, positive, reciprocal relationships. We want to really push that forward."
That's a good place to leave it. Arnie or John, thank you so much for being our guest. Our guest was Dr. John Summers Flanagan, professor of the university's Department of Counseling and the director of the Institute of Positive Education. We'll see you next week, Arnie.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.
Children are the greatest joy and our best hope for a better future. Friends, they are the future. But did you know that millions of kids are facing hunger every day? Food is not just food. It's energy, health, confidence, hope, and even love. Yes, love.
Thank you!
Learn more about how No Kid Hungry is helping end child hunger in America at helpnokidhungry.org.
We asked parents who adopted teens to share their journey.
Nathan has taught me to embrace the moment. Age-wise, I'm in my late 60s. I'm old enough to be his grandfather. Will he be embarrassed to acknowledge me as his dad? I think the most important thing we can do is let them know that they're safe, that they're valued and cared for and loved, and that they're important.
I knew I wanted to be adopted by him because of how he taught me to be the person who I am today. And it's coming from a dad that didn't expect to become a dad, and I feel very proud to be his son.
That was what he needed, and he was what I needed. Every day is full of new opportunities. That's what it's been about, realizing the simple things that it takes to make such a huge difference in these kids' lives.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.